With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Merkel Media.
Lashback Fridays here on Macroaggressions, taking you back to May 15th, 2021. Medical martial law and the pivot to Asia with James Corbett. Hey, if you're thinking of converting some of your soon-to-be worthless Federal Reserve notes into tangible assets like gold and silver, or maybe your IRA and 401k, talk to our sponsor, Tony Arterburn, over at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver. Go to www.macroaggressions.gold. Now, please enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese, please.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Perdita!
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff to German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, or YouTube, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We certainly do appreciate your support. And we couldn't do it without our sponsors. Tim James from Chemical Free Body has been fantastic to us. He's been on the show a couple of times. And one of the things last time I spoke with him, he challenged me to put in 90 days on his Total Energy and Detox Bundle. And so I did. I took the challenge. He sent me two containers of Green 85 juice formula, gut detox, toxin detox, probiotics, and ultra enzymes. And after 90 days, I promised him I would record a video to show him the results of that. And you can find that at chemicalfreebody.com/macro. And you can take advantage of the bundle as well. Take a look there. See if there's something that you like. Of course, when it comes to Chemical Free Body, no, it's gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free. It's vegan, chemical-free, obviously, as the name implies. So take a look. Go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro. And Well, I'll tell you, after the year we've been through, if you aren't thinking about getting yourself prepared, then you need to have your head examined, perhaps. Go to, My Patriot Supply has been nice enough to create our own website for us. It's preparewithmacroaggressions.com. And you can take a look there. You can get a 4-week emergency supply of food. You'll save some money there as well. They have free shipping inside the continental United States, but it's not just food. They also have plenty of supplies. And look, get yourself prepared, whether you do it through My Patriot Supply or whether you do it individually. Start thinking about this. Be proactive. You'd rather be a month or two early than a day late on this. I mean, if you thought the lines for toilet paper were a nightmare, wait until we start to have supply shortages when it comes to food. So hopefully it doesn't get that way. So just take a couple minutes and be proactive. Go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com. Well, last time I had our current guest on the program, the pandemic was just kicking off, and we were speculating about where it might go and how it might unfold. And unfortunately, we put on our little investigative hats, and we were quite right. So it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program the host of the Corbett Report and New World Next Week, James Corbett. Hey, James, how are you? Good to see you again.
Yeah. Well, as good as can be expected given the circumstances. But yeah, wouldn't it be really awesome if we were super, completely, totally wrong last time we were talking about this?
I've never wanted to be so wrong in my life, you know, because what we speculated about was, you know, what if they rolled out some form of martial law, but it wasn't martial law that we are used to with tanks and troops on the corners. But what if it was a little bit more of a clever, more subversive type of, what if it was medical martial law? And then we rolled out the virus and everyone did the job of the armed forces for them and just kept themselves in their house. And they just got bombarded with information and fear and everyone's going to die. And yet, of course, that is exactly how it rolled out. It's a shame, of course, because we know how this is, what this has done to society. But you know, you don't need to be Nostradamus to figure this out. You just have to have a sort of an understanding about the way governments work and the way the media in particular function. And then, of course, the lesser known role of the pharmaceutical industry in driving policy and things like that. What we have walked into is nothing short of a cataclysm. But yet, as we're still, and you have done a great job of this, logically and responsibly presenting information that contradicts the official narratives calmly and backed with facts and things like this, and yet it seems that information gets thrown right out the window when hysteria is the only way people want to process this. This is a fascinating psychological study, is it not?
Unfortunately so. And I think that in the most literal sense, I think there is absolutely a lot of information that is being gleaned from the public response to this and that is being fed back into the systems of would-be social and structural control. The social engineers are absolutely having a field day seeing how various pieces of propaganda are filtering through to the masses and how they are responding to them. So I have no doubt there's a lot that's going on. And again, we can say that advisedly, as I just pointed out just last week on New World Next Week with James Evan Pilato, talking about Susan Michie, the card-carrying communist who's part of the UK's SAGE advisory board that helped to advise on the lockdowns. But more to the point, what does she actually specialize in? Oh, behavioral psychology, specifically how to manipulate people for various health purposes. Because, of course, the government cares and loves its citizens, and that's why it has to deploy psychological operations to get them to go along with various agendas. So, yes, there is absolutely a bounty of material to be studied that I'm sure will be studied and dissected for decades to come regarding this propaganda and the way that it has rolled out, the effect that it has had on, well, unfortunately, not just people like you and me who have been around for a while and seen these things, but the children of today and that are growing up in this environment and expecting that this is normal and this is how they, well, of course, everyone walks around with masks all the time and you have to be careful and not get too close to people. This is going deep into the psyche of the most vulnerable and impressionable members of our society. And anyone who doesn't understand that as psychological trauma that is being inflicted on children is, well, unfortunately, is just no longer really a part of the human race. Yeah. I think we are seeing a diverging of the ways right now. And I know that sounds sort of grandiose, but of all the hysteria and things that we should be panicking about, I think there are things that are genuine existential threats to humanity that we should be very, very concerned about. COVID-19 is not one of them.
Yeah, and we've got these physical markers that we can tally and count. Not that anybody is keeping accurate track of these sorts of deaths and infection numbers and things, but it's what you can't quantify that might be the most terrifying. It's the psychological effect that it has on children. Like you said, the normalization of masks. I even see it, you know, with my daughter who's 9 and in school, and they make them wear the mask during the day. And we go out somewhere and she's like, "Daddy, why don't you have your mask on?" I said, "Because we don't need it." You know, and it's like the fact that is even a comment, you know, a little over a year ago, that would be the only time that would be an appropriate comment would be Halloween. And yet this is being sort of rolled out. And now, as of today, we start to see, more of a, you know, yes, we have the psychological component kicking in for the children, but now we're starting to see Pfizer has pushed for approval, or has gotten approval on the vaccine for 12 to 15 year olds. Now that to me,
that's a good point. And I only saw the headline, but you use the word approval. Surely that's not approval, right? That's emergency use authorization.
Correct? It can't be an approval.
Yeah, because it isn't approval. It hasn't been approved for the general population.
Allowed or some, right. I don't know yeah. even what the correct terminology is, because you're right. To call it an approval would be to imply that FDA and everyone is cleared all these trials, and that of course has never happened. So they have now, I don't know how allowed it, whatever. But It reminds me of an Acapulco, actually, watching Dr. Sherry Tenpenny give her Gardasil talk and explaining how it was being rolled out to kids, the HPV vaccine, and how the way in which they used that to specifically target young girls. And then when that wasn't making enough money, they said, well, we should maybe try and target young boys too with it, you know, because HPV for boys, which makes no sense. But we there, in my head, there had always been some sort of maybe imaginary line that it was 18 years and older, right, for these sorts of things. But it seems that when it comes to big pharma and their quest for dollars, there is no line in the sand that they will not cross.
No. And in fact, it's always been the other way around. I mean, it's always about childhood immunizations. And if they can get immunizations for adults, then ka-ching, there's some extra dollars. But it's always been about targeting the children. So it's no surprise at all to me that they're going for children in this scandemic. And yeah, just looking it up right now, yes, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has expanded the emergency use authorization for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to include people ages 12 to 15. So yes, and it's interesting. Even people like yourself or myself might use that word approve, but that is a specific word with a specific legal meaning that they're trying to make the public sort of just swirl it all around in their head as if it's all the same thing, but it is not. It has not been approved yet. And I don't want to put all my eggs in that basket, because there is zero doubt in my mind that a year or two down the road, when all the clinical trials are finished and all of that, I'm sure they will rubber stamp the approved symbol on it. It would be almost inconceivable that they won't. But at any rate, in the meantime, they haven't. And that is an exceptionally important point. Every part of this vaccine rollout has been based on trying to make the public believe things that's categorically are not true and are trivially looked up and understood. For example, this vaccine was never about preventing any sort of infection. The not even the vaccine manufacturers ever said this was about preventing infection. They said we haven't tested for and we don't know if it will have any effect on reducing transmission. Okay, well, but everyone believes that this is about preventing transmission and reducing and preventing infections. where did that belief come from? And how has it been so thoroughly propagated that even the other day I saw a clip of, what's his name, Trevor Noah from The Daily Show going, well, I don't understand. The FDA has just come out with a list of things that you can do once you've been vaccinated. And it's only two more things than if you weren't vaccinated. You still have to wear a mask and you still have to social distance and all this. I don't get it. Either the vaccine works or it doesn't. What are you talking about? Well, what do you mean by work? What do you think this vaccine was even intended to do? And it was only ever intended, according to the manufacturers themselves, to reduce symptoms. You might get a few less sniffles in your 99.98% survival rate for this dreaded disease that we're telling you is sweeping the globe. Just trust us on that and trust our numbers on all of this, which, of course, I do not. But even taking it at face value, this was never about preventing transmission or infection or anything of the sort. But everyone believes it. And it is, I mean, again, this is a masterstroke in psychological operations. And it is an example of how a bald-faced, complete, demonstrable lie can be spread all the way around the globe and get people to take experimental medical interventions, to use themselves as guinea pigs in an ongoing medical experiment because they've been told lies that they kind of believe and haven't even bothered to look up for themselves. I don't know. If this doesn't make you despair for the future of humanity, I don't know what will.
Yeah, well, what was interesting to me was that the vaccine was there to alleviate the symptoms, right, as you said. But then they started looking for asymptomatic people anyway. So what difference does it make if you alleviate the symptoms?
But now they're talking about now for vaccinated people, they're going to use a lower threshold PCR test. So it will give fewer positives, right? So of course, now magically the case demic will disappear amongst the vaccinated. See, it works, guys. It's just the fraud is so basic. It operates at such a childish level that most people will not even bother to look into it because that's just stupid. They wouldn't do that. Yeah, they would. And they're doing it openly in your face and daring you to call them out for it. They are saying the emperor is wearing clothes. I dare you to say he isn't. And most people won't.
Yeah. Yeah, this reminds me, I don't know if it was Goebbels or Goering or maybe both of them talking about the big lie, you know, make it big, but keep it simple. I mean, this is such an obvious lie that it's almost too obvious, you know, that in and of itself makes people think, well, surely they couldn't get everybody to go along with this. And it's like, well, have you been to the mall, you know, in the last decade? Have you interacted with other human beings? I mean, there's a sheeple people mentality. I mean, that terminology exists for a reason. We are very easy to control. I mean, we like to think that we're, oh, you know, that would never work on me, the Jedi mind trick and all that stuff. Or if I was alive in 1939, I would have never joined the Nazi party. I would have never, really? Well, as I'm calling to rat my neighbor out for having too many cars in his driveway on Thanksgiving, you know, this slow indoctrination, and then has been both terrifying and fascinating to watch. And it just goes to show that people in large numbers can be very dangerous when they are being motivated and fed information by the corporate mainstream media. And it's something about that television, man, that same story, if it comes from artificial intelligence, Brian Williams, fake robot Brian Williams, standing up there with a coat and tie and his hair slicked perfectly, and he's in front of that TV. Something about the presentation makes it authentic. Yeah. Whereas you can do a 2-hour, you know, great in-depth expose on this whole thing, backed with facts, research. It will give them no place to go with it. And yet they go, oh, that's conspiracy theory.
No, exactly. Oh, that's a guy sitting there in his living room. Whereas this guy is sitting in a $1 million set, so he must be right. Yeah, no, exactly right. And I guess I'm detached enough from sort of mainstream thinking that I tend to think that no one actually watches TV anymore, right? Or no one actually really thinks they're getting information from the TV anymore. Unfortunately, I know many, many people do. Yeah. But there must be a breaking point that's being reached. And I assume that's obviously part of the reason why the crackdown on the internet and on social media is happening now in such a concerted way, because obviously there is a breakthrough of the information paradigm that did happen in the past couple of decades, and they want to squelch that out by any means necessary. And unfortunately, we know that that means a cyber pandemic. Yes, that's what they are literally calling it. It's going to be a cyber pandemic. And they're talking about cyber polygon and all of this. The World Economic Forum, the next big pandemic is going to be a cybersecurity event, and it's going to make COVID-19 look like a walk in the park. We're being prepped for that on almost a daily basis at this point. And I know where that's going, unfortunately. I know that that will involve widespread internet outages for however long it takes to make people go, no, anything, just give me my Facebook feedback, and it will come back with strings attached. And goodbye anonymity on the internet. It will be attached to some form of internet ID. And everything that you do will be tracked and surveilled openly. And it will be eventually tied to a social credit score that will be eventually tied to your ability to buy and sell with the digital currency. I mean, we know where this is going. It's perfectly obvious. The only question is, how long does it take? How many steps between here and there? But we know where they are trying to push this.
Yeah, let's talk about that too, because we just had here in the United States on the East Coast, we had a cyber attack against a pipeline, an oil pipeline, and the hackers were using ransomware. Well, I can see where this is going. I mean, it's going a couple. There's a couple of different agendas piggybacking off this whole thing. The first is obviously the hack, the cyber attack that Klaus Schwab once again just predicted that there'll be a cyber attack. I don't think this is anywhere near to the one he's talking about, but this is maybe just a warm up. But it also, you can almost see the agenda unfolding where you're going to get one of these cyber attack ransomware type situations where the perpetrators are either Iran always or Russia or China. You know, those three are going to be blamed for it, but they're going to ask for Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency as a way, and they're going to say, see, this is what we're telling you, these cryptocurrencies are all used by a bunch of terrorists and drug dealers and extortionists and things like that. So we get this, and of course I had Whitney Webb on a couple weeks ago. We were talking about the direction that these cyber attacks are going to be headed. So let's just go to some high octane speculation, as Joseph P. Farrell would say. They give us a couple months past COVID. We start to get our feet down, underneath us, and we start to maybe feel like we're getting back to a little bit of the new normal. And then they hit us with a cyber attack. The type of cyber attack that happens on a Friday and shuts down all the banks for a couple days and things like that, and people freak out. How do you see this fictional sort of fantasy scenario like this playing out for these people? Is this... you think they'll do a multi-pronged attack, or is it something just simple like internet goes out, but then it comes back on a couple days later? How do you speculate that this will roll out?
I would say that in order to enact the agenda that they ultimately want to enact, it would have to be more thoroughgoing and a sort of greater cataclysmic type of event than simply a couple of days without internet. A couple of days without internet could be a vacation for a lot of people. Hey, it's kind of nice not to have the buzzing kind of thing. But no, I think what they're looking for is something that brings us to the point where at least we can see the potential collapse of society. Because banking isn't working and all the services that we rely on right now aren't working. And what are we going to do? And at that point, when people are begging for any solution, is the time when they'll love to step in with their pre-made solutions. So I think, and obviously, again, this goes back to digital identity. This is the sort of the glue that's holding all these various agendas together, is the idea of a digital identity. And that's what it's going to come back to. You are going to be given some sort of blockchain identity. Is this Bitcoin? What have I been hearing a lot about this blockchain stuff? Whatever. Anyway, here's my permanent identity, and issued, of course, by the government. And it will keep track of your health records, your online activity, your economic activity, and all of that. And it will make a nice, easy access point for all government services, for traveling between countries, for making sure that you can enter a concert or whatever. I got my vaccine, don't worry. It's all coming down to that. And that's sort of the nexus of all of this. That is the ultimate end goal, is to centralize human activity into these digital identities that will be tied to you forever. And that what are you going to do? Once you're in that system, they can turn you off and on, essentially, by making you a citizen or not, just by a flick of a switch at some far off database location. That's the ultimate control, and that's what this is about.
Yeah, I always speculated that they might do something where there's some sort of cyber attack, and it's blamed on an individual that was anonymous. And, you know, if only we had known who this person was, you know, they did this horrible thing that caused all this pain and killed all these people or whatever. And if only we had known who he was, we would have been able to stop it. But, the problem is the internet is anonymous. Yeah, we have IP addresses, but there's VPNs that can get around that. So we're going to have to, we're really going to have to take a good long look at this. And, I think really the answer is that we get an internet ID card where everybody is, we know who everybody is. We've got digital hate going on social media every day, all day long. We got to get rid of that. We've got anti-Semitism online, people talking about these things, right? So we just have to know exactly who you are at all times. And that way, it'll be for your safety, of course, right? Is that how they rolled out?
Yeah, I agree that will absolutely be part of the narrative. My difference would be, I think that this will have to involve some sort of state actor eventually. They'll have to blame it on Russia or China. Mm-hmm. North Korea, Iran, whatever. Because two birds with one stone, I think they want to kick off the geopolitical tensions at the same time as a potential economic destabilization, at the very least, at the same time as a cyber attack of some sort, would be the kind of holy grail of false flags for them at this particular moment, because that hits pretty much every agenda point. And one thing that I think we need to keep in mind is that when we talk about these things, like, for example, you're going to need to thumbprint to get on the internet or whatever, these kinds of things that to our position today in 2021 still seems like that would be a big jump, and that a lot of people would go, hey, whoa, there's something going on here. We have to understand that every time these types of things are actually introduced, not teased, not forewarned, but actually introduced, is at the point where people are genuinely begging for it, genuinely want it. For example, if you had told people 2 years ago, yeah, you're going to be locking yourself in your house and keeping away from other people at all times, people would have called you absolutely insane. That will never happen. No. And those exact same people who would have called you insane are the ones who are saying you're a horrible grandma killer because you want to go outside of your house. They have been so completely steeped in that. So I think we have to try to put it in the mindset of maximum emergency that will make people actually desire the things that we're talking about here. And I don't see that happening without major economic destabilization and potentially even hot war. And combine all of that with cybersecurity events and all of that, and one could very much see the complete transformation of our society in a very short time scale.
Yeah, and you mentioned hot war, and you're in Asia, and I'm wondering, during the Obama administration, we had the pivot to Asia and the relocation of the fleet from the United States out of the Persian, well, not all out of the Persian Gulf, but they made a concerted effort to really focus on Asia and Spratly Islands and all these invented things that are so-called threats to America and all of this. Berwick and I put out a book, Controlled Demolition of the American Empire. We talk about the Thucydides trap in there, the idea of the rise of a new empire challenges the existing empire, and that they tend to go to war with each other 75% of the time. I'm wondering what your take is on this, because, we're of the age where we lived through part of that, the Cold War with Russia, and it never really turned into much of anything except a great excuse for the military-industrial complex to just ask for more and more money. Is the pivot to Asia, is the threat with China, is this a real threat? Or is this something imagined for the sake of keeping tensions high, keeping stress levels even higher, and of course, keeping the military budget as high as possible?
I think there's a couple of levels on which this is taking place. And one is to note that the Asia-Pacific pivot was much touted, but was largely just bark with very little bite. There wasn't a lot that actually physically took place. And despite the Obama administration's at least professed attempts to pivot away from Middle East and towards Asia, of course, it got bogged down in Syria and with Iran and all of that. So ultimately, I don't think that a lot of actual structural change took place. Except for, of course, more money to throw at the problem. So let's make sure we build up the Navy, et cetera, and to counter these Asia Pacific threats. Now that's still an ongoing process. And I think it's interesting the way this is being framed in a very similar way to that Cold War with the USSR that you were talking about, right down to, for example, the long telegram, which George Kennan wrote for, well, as Mr. X in Foreign Affairs in 1947, which was basically the strategy for the Cold War, what became essentially the official government strategy, being published in the Foreign Affairs Journal? No, never. Now you have the longer telegram, which is talking about China and the US's position with China and framing it in much the same way, that this is going to be a new sort of Cold War era, if that proceeds along the same path. And I could very much see that. I could see that because the Cold War was very helpful for the ruling establishment of the mid 20th century to make sure the fear and hype was always at, you know, 10 or maybe 11, depending how high they wanted to turn it, that justified all sorts of military budgets and all of that. And Eisenhower and the rise of the military industrial complex and all of that story that we know so well, that could serve a very similar purpose in the 21st century, unless they want to really fundamentally transform the entire system. I mean, truly great reset, in which case, nothing is more effective than war, as Reese Commission investigator Norman Dodd observed, talking about the meeting minutes of the Carnegie Endowment in the early days, 1909, 1910, where they decided, you know, no means of changing society is more effective than war. And then they set their aims on, well, how do we steer the United States government into war? I mean, just craziness, but it's right there in black and white. 100 plus years ago, when they were trying to get U.S. into World War I, could that happen in our decade? Several years, the deciding pivotal point of this transition, in so many different respects. And one of them that I find fascinating is, and I know this has just come up recently. Are you getting me? Am I chopping up for you?
Yeah, you got you.
Okay. One of them that just has, I know it's reemerged recently, it comes up every few years, is the Fourth Turning. And I know a lot of people have heard about this, but essentially this was a book that was written in 1997 by a couple of researchers, Strauss and Howe, who were talking about the seculum, which is this 80 to 100 year cycle. It's a generational cycle. And it's essentially follows the same pattern. There's a crisis which creates some sort of new order, and that brings stability and prosperity and happiness for a while. And then there's an awakening which leads to an unraveling, which leads to a new crisis, and the whole cycle starts again. And they're putting it in terms of generational cycles. There's four archetypal generations. There's the prophets, the heroes, the artists, and the nomads, and they come in turns. And of course, it looks different in each era, but you can follow this cycle back in the Anglo-Saxon context all the way back to the Renaissance era. So in the last 500 years, there's been however many seculums changing, and you can see the crisis point coming at about 80-year intervals. And lo and behold, here we are at the next 80-year interval after World War II, coming up in the next few years. And here we are reaching what looks like could be a crisis point. And I don't use this as some sort of woo, you know, spooky, spiritual, supernatural, something is happening kind of thing. But I think there is a logic to that progression of the cycles and the ways that history sort of, it rhymes, it doesn't repeat, it rhymes. You know, we've heard this before. And I think we are reaching that point. And I certainly see parallels, and I've pointed this out before, the pre-World War I period to right now, a lot of different parallels that line up, and the most obvious of which is the rising power of China versus the US juggernaut, the rising power of Germany against the UK juggernaut. It's a very, again, maybe not mirror image, but it's very similar. And I see a lot of parallels, and that leads to the possibility of war. And I think people, again, with normalcy bias, tend to just completely dismiss that possibility. Oh, it won't go really hot. It'll just be a new Cold War or something. I don't know. I know war is a transformative event. There's no way around it. Absolutely. In the event of the next major outbreak of war between world superpowers, we can't even envision what that will look like. In the same way that people pre-World War One could not have imagined what warfare would look like in the 20th century. I mean, they were still thinking 19th century type of warfare, and then they got this mechanized machine gun trench warfare that no one could have even envisioned before that point. Can you imagine what it would look like in the 21st century? I don't want to, but we very well could be heading into those times. And after that, all bets are off the table. Who knows what comes on the other side of that kind of transformative event? But I know that they are planning and thinking about it as we speak. Just as World War One led to the League of Nations and that idea and transformed the idea of international justice and all that, World War II led, of course, to the United Nations, which was already being talked about and planned by the Council on Foreign Relations in the 1940s before the end of the war. They were already planning for the post-war period and the United Nations and all of that. World War III, dot, 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 fill in the blanks. What will come next? And if it isn't a techno-fascist dictatorship, then yay, because that's the direction that this seems to be tending.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on what you feel how America or the West, let's just say, sees China's Silk Road project. I would imagine that they would see that as a threat. That's my guess. They could see it as an opportunity. I don't know that they would, because they like to control those opportunities. But the role of China in developing out this Silk Road and this, frankly, the development of Africa as well. It seems like they've taken a much different approach to this. And I kind of joked in my book that, you know, in Africa, the Chinese build hospitals for sick Africans, where the Americans build graveyards for dead ones. We have a very savage default mechanism in the West, especially in the United States, when it comes to imposing our foreign policy around the world. And China, of course, has authoritarian dreams in their own country, but they tend to sort of keep their sphere of influence rather contained to their geographical region. I wonder now, is the Silk Road an opportunity for them to finally start to spread out and spread their influence throughout the world?
If that is what the global controllers want. We'll put it that way. I'm not a proponent of the monolithic conspiracy that there's just one group or one family that controls everything and they dictate everything that happens in the world. But having said that, major transformative economic and military and other types of events, I think, don't take place unless there is a confluence of interests amongst the most powerful groups to allow that to take place. So something like the Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road initiative, is interesting, again, with the historical parallels. You could look, for example, at the Berlin-Baghdad Railway, which the rising German power was trying to construct in that pre-World War I period to facilitate trade to the Middle East at that time, to Baghdad. They were, I think, 900 kilometers away from completion at the outbreak of World War I. And that is an oft-neglected part of the factors that went into World War I, that they were trying to build this trading route, this trading corridor that could have very much changed the energy calculus, for example, for Russia, as, of course, the still largely untapped reserves, the oil reserves in the Middle East would have been essentially at their doorstep with the completion of that railway. So that was an important part of the strategic threat that I'm sure went into the calculus of when and how they should have pulled the trigger on World War One and starting that conflagration. So the One Belt, One Road, I mean, again, an American empire, an Anglo empire, whatever you want to call it, sit there and passively allow such a fundamental structural economic threat to its existence simply to be erected? And okay, I guess let the best man win. I guess they get it. I don't see that as being a likely outcome for this. I see it as being a potential flashpoint for, at the very least, information warfare. And we see that playing out right now, where China is obviously being demonized from a lot of different quarters, and people who would various countries that, in some sort of completely in some world that had zero history and nothing, sort of no relations, and no one thought about anything, you would expect Australia and Japan and sort of the Asia Pacific generally would see this rising economic power in China and, okay, well, we should start trading more with them and we should have better relations with them. But of course, that isn't happening. No, of course, it is perceived as a threat and potentially rightly so, because of course, China is building up its military at the same time. And unfortunately, even in the independent media, there is the tendency to think, well, the bad guy clearly over here, so that must be a good guy, I guess. There are absolutely no clean hands in this. The Chi-Com authoritarian techno-fascist dictatorship is the model for what they're trying to institute in America and elsewhere. So I don't see that as some sort of, it's going to be a saving grace. And the way that China is putting various partners in this One Belt, One Road into precarious situations where, okay, we'll build your port and we'll help, you know, we'll help facilitate this trade, but now you owe us. And if you don't pay back, we'll just claim the port and we'll take it back. And we will now control your economic infrastructure. And just because the Chinese dragon hasn't exactly been breathing fire on its erstwhile trading partners yet, doesn't mean they won't do so in the future. And I think a lot of people are wary and understanding of that. But then again, I mean, it's this crazy back and forth where you look, for example, at the way the Uyghurs are being treated and the Xinjiang concentration camps and all of this. And yeah, that's terrible. That's horrible. But then you look and you see, oh, well, it's a lot of US NGOs that are funding this sort of research that's coming out with a lot of these questionable accounts of what's going on in the camps and other things. So, well, okay, so clearly it's an op to undermine the Chinese government, so we have to be against that. But there's actually people in Xinjiang who really are, and you start playing this weird calculus of, you know, which side I'm going to take, until you realize this isn't a game and you don't choose sides. Both sides are playing against you. You are the end target of all of this, and it is designed to capture your fealty, your allegiance. And I don't think at the end of the day, the people who really control this game really care whether you're on Team America or Team China or whatever way that you ultimately put those things, because they are going to be the same thing. At the end of the day, they are going to merge. And if not actually merge, then I could see something very much like 1984. If you want to do high octane speculation, let's speculate about a world divided into Eurasia, East Asia, and Oceania. And you live in one of these regions and you are told that we're at war with this other region, or no, not that region, this region. We've always been at war with this region. What's going on today? There's bombs dropping on you. You don't know where they're coming from. They're telling you it's from that evil enemy, I guess. Okay, well, anyway, we got a shelter in place now. That's the vision of the future that I think is perhaps most likely, rather than a global government, which at the very least, we could imagine that there would be resistance to a global government that sets itself in place. But if they have a sort of regional thing where it's those evil Chi-Coms versus us virtuous Westerners or whatever it is, that's a great way of controlling vast swaths of humanity and keeping them in that mindset, because we always want to choose a side.
I think where they have planned for us is this to all be on one team, and that is the team that eats crickets, because what we're seeing is that the World Economic Forum, let's continue our trek east and wind up in Davos eventually, and these maniacs at the World Economic Forum, boy, you know, their marketing campaign is lacking, to say the least. I mean, to the idea you'll own nothing and you'll never be happier. We've got that going for us. We've got, you know, hey, look at all these delicious bugs that you get to choose from. We're going to start incorporating these into your diet. You know, I don't need to be beat over the head to get the message. These people hate our guts, and they are unfortunately in a position of power. For now, and that is not something that I don't want to take them lightly, but I also don't want to deify them either. These are just human beings that are, yes, they're wealthy and yes, they're very powerful, but they are few. They are the grasshoppers. We are the ants in this sort of game. But if it's up to them, they have a much different version of reality for us. We've heard of Agenda 2030, micro apartments tied to this whole thing. What do you think the role of the World Economic Forum is going to be moving forward? Have they overplayed their hand? Because a lot of people, not everybody obviously, but a lot of people are kind of waking up to this game. And I suppose it doesn't help that the head of the World Economic Forum is a straight up supervillain, even down to the German accent and the uniforms. But all that aside, I mean, taking that sort of buffoonery out of it, this is a dangerous collection of individuals, and they seem to have a plan for us, do they not?
Yeah. In fact, I like the way you put it. I think they want us to think there will be two teams in this coming conflict that they're engineering. It will be us virtuous, wonderful Westerners who will be eating crickets and corralled into smaller and smaller urban areas and allowed a certain amount of carbon rationed so that we can scrape by some sort of meager living that we scrape out of the land We won't even have land. No, it'll all be produced in factories, and we'll have to do menial slave labor for the, you know, to engineer the robots that will run our society. Great. And we'll have the UBI tied into our social credit and all of this. And that's our wonderful team versus those evil chi-coms in which people will be eating crickets and rounded up into our small urban areas and have social credit tied into their UBI. It will be the same thing, right? And so in reality, the two teams are the vast majority of the human species versus the very few at the top who seek to control that system and who get to be the overlords who will literally be flying around in the skies while we're all trapped in our little cities and, oh, you can't fly. Imagine how many carbon credits you'd need to do that. That's the vision, the neo-feudal vision of the neo-feudal lords on the neo-feudal global plantation. And that's, I think, the reality they're attempting to engineer. So that's the way that really works. In that system, I mean, the World Economic Forum, yes. Have they overplayed their hand? Certainly, I think they've drawn too much attention to themselves at this point. And so it would be in their interest even to lay back a little bit and maybe not push the Great Reset agenda quite so hard, at least not in the public at this moment, if they wanted to maintain sort of the establishment institutional place that they have within this New World Order framework that's coming into view. But the World Economic Forum, even, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations, you name it, Bilderberg, whatever, these are just shells that can be occupied by various people who are, as you say, human beings. And it's a very good point to make, and one that deserves to be made, because I think they genuinely see themselves as, if not a separate biological species, at least obviously they're the Übermensch who deserve to rule over us peons. And that's the sort of the fundamental eugenics ideology that I think drives a lot of these people. But so they see themselves as different. And even in the independent media, a lot of people see them as being fundamentally different. They're, you know, shape-shifting reptiles or whatever. No, these are human beings who are occupying positions of power because they are psychopathic and they genuinely desire control over other people. And they have worked meticulously to make that happen. They will do whatever it takes, sell out whoever needs to be sold out, crawl, you know, slit their own grandmother's throat if it gets them a place in the hierarchical pecking order, figuratively or literally, maybe. And so those are the types of people who tend to inhabit these positions. And I don't think they care about this particular organization, the World Economic Forum or the Council on Foreign Relations or whatever it is. Those are just convenient vehicles that exist at the moment to wield institutional power from. But that's not where the power derives from. So they'll just use them to the extent that they have leverage to enact the superclass's agenda. The superclass, of course, as defined by David Rothkopf, the 6,000 or so individuals who operate supranationally. They're not tied to any particular nation state. I mean, they, I'm sure, possess some sort of passport that has some sort of nation state on it, but they don't see themselves as allied to that. No, they have their own agendas, and they can interact and transact across borders in ways that you and I obviously can't. That's the instantiation of what the real teams are. It's you and me and everyone else who's listening to this conversation versus the few people at the very top. It is the bug's life, you know, the ants versus the grasshoppers kind of thing.
Yeah. And back to when I had Whitney on, we were talking about the new DARPA, the health DARPA, HARPA, to kind of, I guess, break it down like that. because DARPA is so wonderful with their, funding of robot dogs and all kinds of, their relationship with companies like Boston Dynamics and creating these dystopian, nightmarish Terminator type machines. And obviously they go basically unchecked and get free reign to concoct the most diabolical creations. They then take this sort of concept from defense advanced research programs and migrate that to health advanced research programs. What could possibly go wrong with that, right? I mean, this is unfortunately, as people, pull back a little bit and get a bigger picture of the world, they start to see, hang on a second, this coronavirus situation didn't ever really feel all that organic. It seemed a bit forced. And then you start to see the march towards this, to the health passports, the health, the blending of big pharma and big tech, two of the worst institutions ever, combined with the power of the government and the money of the central banks to create this sort of the empire, from, to borrow a Star Wars term. So let's put on our little, look into the future a little bit and just speculate as to where things could go in a couple years using this idea of a HARPA concept of sort of a quasi-governmental, quasi-private health institute that is devouring data from users through voluntary information, wearable devices, tracking of some kind, however you want to define that, feeding that into a big data computer that's then processing that and making determinations on you. I mean, it's got health insurance implications, it's got life insurance implications, it's got death panel implications. I mean, you name it. Every dystopian fantasy can be crammed into this, right?
Yeah. And let's not speculate. Let's actually just go and read what they're writing about this. So I've talked, for example, about the biosecurity state and how that is the new paradigm that they're going to be operating on. We're transitioning from the war of terror paradigm into the biosecurity state paradigm, where essentially your ability to act and interact and transact in the world will be dependent on the government allowing you to do so, and they will screen your biological identity to allow you to participate. So it's all about that. And we can talk about all the crazy tech that they're advancing right now for being able to detect COVID-19 by, implantable gels, hydrogels that they're going to implant in you. And if you have certain symptoms, it will be able to broadcast them to the nearest smartphone, and I'm infected, I better go to the disinfecting center or the quarantine center or whatever. Again, sounds outlandish till you read the mundane, boring headlines about how they're already developing this technology. That's the kind of thing that the HARPAs of the world will be working towards, which is just every aspect of the complete biosurveillance grid, which will be the ultimate control grid, because it will control you on a literal biological level. And again, we don't have to speculate about this. So let's bring the international perspective into this. I just got an email alerting me to the existence of this document, which I had not seen, but which was released in February of 2020. So just before all of the madness really kicked off in earnest. In fact, as you and I were at Anarchapoco, the government of Canada, specifically Policy Horizons Canada, released a document called Exploring Biodigital Convergence, in which they talk about where this is trending. And again, this shouldn't be surprising to my regular listeners, but it deserves to be documented. It says, for example, in the coming years, biodigital technologies could be woven into our lives in the way that digital technologies are now. Biological and digital systems are converging and could change the way we work, live, and even evolve as a species. More than a technological change, this biodigital convergence may transform the way we understand ourselves and cause us to redefine what we consider human or natural. Biodigital convergence may profoundly impact our economy, our ecosystems, and our society. Being prepared to support it while managing its risks with care and sensitivity will shape the way we navigate social and ethical considerations, as well as guide policy and governance conversations. And you can go and read through this document, and they hit all of the main themes. Three ways biodigital convergence is emerging. Number one, full physical integration of biological and digital entities. Two, co-evolution of biological and digital technologies. And three, conceptual convergence of biological and digital systems. And go read through this nightmare document for the examples of how they're thinking along these lines and where this is going. But I'll cut to the chase if you want it. Transhumanism. That is what this is about. It is about literally ending the human species as we know it and replacing it with a perfectly malleable, perfectly pliable, perfectly programmable, essentially biological robot class that will be at the disposal of whoever is controlling that, whoever is programming it. And this type of analogy of the human computer is not one that I'm coming up with myself. As people I'm sure have seen by now, Moderna for years has been talking about the software of life, aka the mRNA that can be inserted now via vaccines. It's a vaccine, everyone, to literally reprogram the way your body produces proteins. And it does not take a genius level intellect to understand how that can be used to ultimately program the human body into whatever the controllers want it to be down the road. I'm sure technologically it's probably not that fine-tuned at the moment, but now that they're instituting they're getting the precedent set and the infrastructure in place so that whenever they push that panic button, people will line up to get their experimental injection. And now you're hooked for life, because now it seems, oh, you're going to need a booster in a few months. Oh, you're going to need another booster in a year. And how, you know, let me just make another wild bet. I bet this is going to be, you're going to need a booster every year for the rest of your life. And what will that booster contain? Will it always be the same thing, or will they change the formula slightly somewhere down the road? And in fact, why bother with all these separate injections for all these different things that are going to pop up? Because we're living in the era of pandemics. We're waiting for pandemic two, right, Bill Gates? Now, why do that when we could just inject something that will be programmable from a distance, and it will be able to create whatever proteins we want at whatever time, just by they'll beam it into you once you get your update for your vaccine, everyone. That's it. That's where this is going. So it is about reprogramming the human species into some sort of transhuman entity. And that's why I say this is an existential threat to humanity. Truly, the human species is on the line right now. They already are openly admitting they are working on the technologies to transform us into this whatever biological digital convergence that we will co-evolve as some sort of new species with the new digital versions of whatever they're programming into our bodies. They're openly talking about this. This is not science fiction. This is not coming from crazy James Corbett conspiracy theorists. This is literally Government of Canada open documents that you can go and read right now. But how many people are going to do it, despite the fact literally the human species is on the line here? I don't know what to say after that. I don't know how else I can put this. I don't know how much more loudly I can ring this alarm bell.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And it reminds me of what they did with genetically modified organisms. So you've got a tomato, and a tomato is a tomato, and you can't patent it. But if you change a little bit of the tomato, now technically it's not a tomato, and you can own the patent. You own that. With an mRNA vaccine that goes into the human body, by default, it changes you into something that is maybe a little bit less human. Is there a possibility? And this is, you know, just trying to think like a psychopath here, but is there a possibility that they can change you enough from a legal standpoint that you are no longer a human being, and then they, in fact, now even own you?
That's a very good question. And in fact, one that I answered in my questions for Corbett series last year. I did have a question about this. So I did have an entire podcast talking about the legal issues of patenting life forms, which has been on the books in the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, since 1981 with the Diamond v. Chakrabarty decision about, I believe that was about biological bacteria that had been engineered to eat petroleum or something to clean up oil spills. And I believe it was that particular ruling that the Supreme Court said, yep, you could patent new life forms. So that sort of opened the gates to this new industry that has arisen since then in genetically modified life forms. There are asterisks and different rulings that have been made over the years on that. So I went through all that in Questions for Corbett number 64, will genetically modified humans be patented? But don't worry, Charlie, that has nothing to do with the mRNA vaccines, because don't worry, mRNA doesn't penetrate the cell nucleus. It doesn't change you on a genomic level. It's just there. The cell sees it, it reads it, it encodes the proteins, and then it disappears. And there's no long-lasting effects. How do we know this? Well, we don't, because it's an ongoing medical experiment. But anyway, there's no possible way that we can possibly imagine that this could possibly get into your nucleus, except reverse transcriptase. But don't worry about that. Doesn't matter. That's just for rare things, HIV and other things. That doesn't actually matter. Put this into any fact checker and they'll have a million ways of telling you that this has no bearing on that, Charlie. But anyway, we know this is where this is going, towards genetic modification of the human being, and that there are already laws on the books that could make it possible for companies to end up patenting things that exist inside your body. That is something that has been tested in courts before with regards to screening for breast cancer. There were literally companies saying that they owned the patent to certain biological markers that were used for that screening process. I can't remember the details off the top of my head, but again, it's in that Questions for Corbett. That thankfully got struck down by the courts, but that isn't a ruling that can or will likely stand forever. This is going to be tested more and more frequently, and especially now that HARPA and Government of Canada and all of these other government agencies are working on the various biological upgrades. And who's helping to fund and sponsor all of this? People like Bill Gates, who of course is now finally, there's a bit of questioning going on in the mainstream land. Hey, he seems to be really into intellectual property. Why is he so into intellectual property? No, we need to get this wonderful life-saving vaccine to everyone in the world. That'll save everyone. So why is he trying to stop it with this intellectual property thing? Bill Gates for intellectual property? That's a surprise. I never would have thought that. Yeah. So where is this going to go as we start talking about genetically modifying humans and the ability to patent those modifications?
I mean, that's a guy that would know a thing or two about genetically modified foods, as he was one of, I'm not sure if he still is, one of the largest shareholders of Monsanto. He obviously financed the Spalsvard seed vault in Norway. That's great. You know, so he financed the GMO seeds for the plebs and then take the real seeds and literally hide them in a cave up on the top of a cliff 1,100 kilometers south of the North Pole inside the Arctic Circle, because that's normal. And then maybe you guys can get, and then I'll buy all the farmland too, because I want what's best for you. But
he'll invest in the lab-grown meat as well. Don't forget.
Lab-grown meat. Yes. How could I forget about that? But, let's end this with going back to your home country of Canada, and I'm curious to get your take on the response, the authoritarian response. I must have had a different vision of Canada than in my mind than some people, because in my head it was a very accommodating culture. Well, the culture's still the same. I'm talking, maybe the government is different, but you know, easygoing, likable, fun-loving people in Canada. And I always thought of the government as, you know, maybe they went along a bit with the crown, and they went along with, if America said, hey, listen, we're going to go invade Iraq, you coming with us? They're like, oh, okay, sure, we'll go. I never pegged them as being authoritarian monsters until this last year. And what I have seen with the arresting of Pastor Arthur Pulaski in Calgary, we've seen the arresting of the kids playing hockey. We're watching, you know, the insanity of this. Did I just have my head up my ass? Or is this a new sort of Justin Castro type, decree that is relatively recent? Because in my head, none of this wasn't a Canadian, type of reaction to this, but yet what I'm seeing is like East Germany all over
again. Yeah. Well, let me correct you. When America said, hey, we're going into Iraq, Canada said no. That was a big point. Kretchen at the time said, no, we're not going into Iraq. This hasn't been approved by the UN and all of that. So that actually plays into the Canadian self-identity and perhaps the image they project around the world, which is moral superiority to those barbaric Americans. And look at them with their, you know, disintegrating culture and their race wars and their, you know, gun murders and all of this. Like, oh, they're crazy down there. We are the Canadians. We float on a cloud and we're so much better than them. And there is a very, very strong sense of anti-Americanism that's bred deep in the bones in Canada about that moral superiority. And that plays into things like, well, we didn't go into Iraq and things like that. So that unfortunately actually plays directly into what is happening right now, because there is a very definite smugness about Canadians who genuinely believe they are morally superior. And as evidence of this, we're fun, we're easygoing, you know, hey man, it's okay. Oh, sorry. You know, are you okay? You know, the very caring culture and all of that, very polite, but that means very deferential to governmental authority and also very, very trusting of governmental authority. Yeah. The American government is crazy, out of control. They're just the crazy, but our government is all about peace. And look, it was the UN that started, the Canadians that started the UN peacekeepers, and that did such wonderful things like raping children in various countries and all of that. I mean, it's just such a beautiful legacy that Canada has. And it's all about peace and harmony and all of this. And that's the self-image. And that means that there is a huge amount of just blind faith and trust in government and in authority. And when the government says something, Canadians listen. And it's because they care. They love us. They have our best interests in mind. Unfortunately, that is the mentality. And that hasn't been as abused as it has been in the last couple of decades, but certainly over the past year. And I can speak to this because I remember back in the day when I used to listen to Alex Jones way back in the day, and he would say, I've never encountered more crazy Gestapo Nazis than I did at the Canadian border trying to get into to Bullhorn Bilderberg in 2006. And they kept him there for 48 hours or something and couldn't talk to his lawyer and all of this. And he was insistent that the Canadians are actually worse than TSA and Americans and stuff like this. And at the time I thought, well, that might be true, but I don't know. Until I was going back for a wedding. I was going to be a best man at my friend's wedding, and I'm going through the border with my Canadian passport. I'm a Canadian citizen returning to Canada. So, you know, here we go. I make a silly joke about, you know, oh, Calgary's going to win the Stanley Cup this year to the Vancouver border agent. He does not laugh. He makes some sort of squiggle on my customs card. And the next thing I know, I'm being dragged off for special screening, and they're going through all my stuff and giving me the full treatment of, you know, literally reading my diary and things like this. And can we photocopy this? I don't know. Can you? Like, I don't know my rights here. It was a crazy experience that really did open my eyes to, yeah, there is an absolute authoritarian streak in Canadian in government and in law enforcement in Canada. And most of the Canadian public is totally fine with it, totally on board with it, because the government loves us. So sadly, it's not completely surprising to me to see the way that the Canadian public has been so easily steered into the panic by primarily, I would say, the CBC, but I'm sure every media outlet there in Canada has been selling them on the fear porn over COVID the whole time and insisting that the only way out is the vaccines. It's funny, I was just talking to my friend here in Japan the other day, who's also Canadian. He was talking to his sister back in Canada, and his sister was trying to tell him, oh, are you going to get the vaccine? And he said, well, actually, just going from the statistics here in Japan, I would statistically have more of a risk from the vaccine than from actually dying of this COVID, even by the Japanese government numbers. And he was just pointing it out just as a straight statistical calculation based on the officially approved numbers. She got so angry at him. She's not speaking to him anymore. Like, how dare you question this? How dare you suggest that what we are being told in the media isn't true? So unfortunately, no, the Canadians have a deep, deep streak of just blindly trusting authority and rallying around that flag, and whatever they're being told is the right thing. So sadly, no, they have been, I think they're kind of the front line of this march of the, at least the West, towards the CHICOM style system of top-down complete authoritarian control, I think the Canadians will be first in line to accept the brain chip from Klaus Schwab.
That's disappointing. But everybody knows that the closest the Vancouver Canucks were going to come to winning the Stanley Cup was in 94 when they had Pavel Bure. If they blew that, you know, those days are, or those days are gone. James, where can people find your work?
This is my mouse pad from the last time the Flames had a chance, 2004.
Yep.
Those were the days. Where can people find my work? CorbettReport.com. That's the one-stop shop. I am on various other platforms. I'm being scrubbed from various other platforms. Anyway, that's just details. But if you go to CorbettReport.com, that's where you can find all of my work. Hopefully, meticulously documented work. So again, if you're interested in anything that we've been talking about today, chances are if you type it in the search bar, you'll find a lot more material about it and a lot more depth with a lot of documentation and references, transhumanism, biosecurity, the patent issue that we talked about. It's all there and it's all for free. This work is a resource. Please use it as such. Inform yourself, inform others. The very future of humanity is on the line, and I cannot state that strongly enough.
Yeah, and everyone that goes to go to CorbettReport.com and also sign up for the email newsletter. It's the best way that James can keep in touch with you directly. God knows this censorship is not going to end well. And of course, we may all be excited that James is on the program. The algorithms will not be. So take the additional step of taking this episode and sharing it with your friends and family. James, you're the best. Thank you so much for everything that you do. And we will see everybody back here real soon.